This is Josh Barrow, and welcome to Left, Right, and Center, your civilized yet provocative antidote to the self-contained opinion bubbles that dominate political debate. It was the third week of November, and this week at least Gordon Sondland appeared to be enjoying himself. The House Intelligence Committee heard three more days of public testimony, undermining a couple of key arguments the president's defenders had been making. For one, EU Ambassador Sondland said he was tasked with executing a quid pro quo. Get the Ukrainians to announce an investigation into Burisma, which effectively meant the Bidens, in exchange for a White House meeting. He also said he later came to understand military aid to Ukraine as also being part of that quid pro quo deal. And he said the Ukrainians didn't necessarily have to conduct the investigation. They just had to announce the investigation. So much for the president's sincere interest in corruption in Ukraine. Then there was the argument that the Ukrainians couldn't have been extorted through the withholding of military aid because they didn't even know the aid was being withheld. But we've now learned that the Ukrainian embassy emailed the State Department asking what was up with the aid on July 25th, a month earlier than they were previously known to have known about the holdup, and the same day that President Trump had his perfect phone call with Ukrainian President Zelensky. But while these hearings have made for compelling television and made clear the White House has lied about a number of things, it's not clear they've changed the underlying political situation at all. To talk about why, I'm going to bring in our Left, Right, and Center panel. As always, I'm your center. I'm joined by Rich Lowry, editor of National Review on the right. On the left is Elizabeth Bruning of The Washington Post, and we also have a special guest today, Jonathan Capehart, who is also a columnist at The Washington Post. Hello, everybody.
Hi, Josh.
Hey, Josh.
Hi, Josh.
I actually want to start with a different story that I think is in an odd way related to this story, which is President Trump's intervention in three military justice cases where he pardoned or vacated charges against three military service members who'd been accused of war crimes, such as ordering soldiers to shoot on unarmed Afghan civilians. The president took this move to intervene in these cases against the advice of Pentagon officials. Apparently, Fox News host Pete Hegseth had been a key advocate for these moves. And they reflect a broader sentiment on the president's part that the military should not be too constrained by rules of war, that we shouldn't require these people to be nice, as he might put it. According to the Washington Post, the president expressed to one of the pardoned officers that he thought the military justice process was fixed to produce unfair convictions. Rich, is there any justification for these moves the president's made?
I think it shows poor judgment. The three cases, the one involving a guy who's convicted, seems the absolute worst. He ordered his men to shoot Afghans, at least who didn't represent a threat and were quite far away, and he just seemed to be nailed on this matter. The other one hasn't actually gone to trial. The third one involves a case where he was accused of killing a prisoner. Someone else confessed to killing the prisoner, but he still posed with a body, which is supposed to get you a demotion, regularly gets you a demotion, and the Navy is going to demote him, and Trump said, nope, no, you're not. And this is just an unwise intervention far down in the Navy's chain of command.
Liz, the president likes to talk about law and order, and I think Chris Hayes from MSNBC has a really smart way that he talks about this, which is what the order element means, that order reflects an idea that certain people in society should have power and others should not. And so that order, for example, means that tough military officers ought to be able to do what they want as they fight in war zones, should be unconstrained by rules. It seems like that has taken precedence here over law.
Yeah, I mean, it's sort of a typical proto-fascist approach to establishing order, which actually means establishing hierarchy, which means enforcing power. That's what people like Trump mean when they talk about order. They don't mean well-run systems. They just mean the enforcement of a kind of brutal hierarchy, and the enforcement tends to take precedence much less than trying to, say, coerce or cajole people into, participating in this hierarchy. They tend to focus on inflicting it by force. So Trump's pardons are all part of that way of establishing order, and it's extraordinarily destructive, and it's order in name only. It's actually very chaotic because it's dispensing with, like you said, rules of war that are internationally established and well understood.
And so, Jonathan, the role that law seems to play in this, and we see this in the Ukraine scandal, is that law can be a tool for that kind of order, which is, you know, it's like the Oscar Benavides line, the long ago president of Peru: "For my friends, everything; for my enemies, the law." And so he perceives his opponents, whether they are Hillary Clinton or Joe Biden, as having run afoul of the law, and wants to use the law as a tool to impose order. But then, of course, he's presided over administration where a lot of people have broken the law, and he's used a lot of pardons to sort of undermine the rule of law in certain areas.
Yes, well, the word that comes to mind for me is arbitrary. he applies the law in this arbitrary way. I think Liz was just saying there's no real order to all of this. It's all very chaotic. And if it suits his personal or political benefit, then the law is fine. He'll exercise it. But if it doesn't suit his personal or political beliefs or his own benefit, he will ignore the law, as we're seeing in the case of the pardons he issued.
Rich, is this an unfair characterization?
I think the impulse is that we need to be tough, and then there's an overlapping impulse that systems are rigged, and they're, you know, he believes these guys all fit under those two rubrics, but is listening to really poor advice and disregarding the advice of his professionals, which was a theme in the Ukraine scandal as well. And a use of, you know, this is a lawful use of his power. It's just an arbitrary and unworthy use of his power.
So I'm not quite going to ask you the question I've been asking every week about, you know, so did what we learned this week change the calculus about impeachment? But I just want to ask if, you know, what I see having happened here is that it's an important political goal for the president that he should be able to engage in certain kinds of lawlessness and corruption. That's not really an important political goal institutionally of the Republican Party. It's not an organization that's set out so that Donald Trump could have the Republican National Committee buy a bunch of his son's books, or so that he could, you know, hold party functions at his own resort, try to hold the G7 there. But there are things that institutionally people in the Republican Party want. They want judicial appointments, they want tax cuts, that sort of thing. And so is this just a really weird example of log rolling, which is to say the political science concept where you build a coalition because certain people in it want one thing and certain people want another thing? So you have people who want conservative policies, and they've agreed to be log rolled in with a package of policies that is basically corruption for the Trump family.
I think there's an incentive to look the other way or minimize it. Definitely, in part because they're getting important things they want, in part because they fear the consequences of fully opposing him and having him drop a nuclear bomb on their head. I do think, though, Republicans sincerely don't think that this justifies removal. You had Will Hurd, a Trump skeptical, retiring Republican, who said the other day he thinks this was improper, but doesn't justify impeachment removal. Mark Sanford, who's briefly running against Trump, said the other day he doesn't think it justifies impeachment and removal. So this just goes to the core of my case. If this was just like the Iran-Contra hearings in the Reagan years, and all Democrats were doing was exposing what actually happened, extracting a political price and all these damaging revelations, it'd clearly be a home run. The question is whether this episode can justify the weight of removing a president for the first time in our history. And I think it doesn't, and we'll see where the polling comes out you know, in a week or so when the last 2 weeks are fully absorbed. But there's at least a sign of sagging in support of impeachment, certainly no longer gaining momentum.
Yeah, Jonathan, what do you make of that? I think Will Hurd, who's this moderate member of the House Intelligence Committee, has broken with Donald Trump on a number of issues. As Rich notes, he's not seeking re-election. He'd been sort of pegged as the sort of person that Democrats might bring around to vote for impeachment, and he pretty clearly telegraphed this week that he's not going to do that. Are you surprised by that? And what does it say that it looks like this is impeachment's going to come out of the House very likely with zero Republican votes?
I would love to say that I am surprised. I mean, here's a person who is retiring from Congress. He has nothing to lose. He has nothing to fear. And yet it was just, to me, another example of Republicans twisting themselves into pretzels to not run afoul of the party as it now is in the reflection of President Trump. It seems to me that as damaging as these hearings have been over the last 2 weeks, as damaging as they have been to the president, the presidency, what it says, especially since Fiona Hill's testimony, what it says about the foundation of our democracy, the idea that articles of impeachment could come out of the House with zero Republican votes says a lot more, I think, about where the Republican Party is today than it does about any kind of strategy, any kind of political calculus that went into the Democrats' decision to go down this road.
Liz, I mean, how do you feel about that lack, that apparent lack of Republican votes we're going to get for this? Because it suggests to me, I mean, I guess the question is what Democrats' goal was with impeachment to begin with. If the idea was to achieve removal of the president, then obviously no Republican votes in the House is a strong sign that you're going to get almost no Republican votes in the Senate, certainly not enough to remove him. But if impeachment served other purposes, maybe you don't need that Republican support.
Yeah, I mean, I'm not totally clear on exactly what Democrats were expecting when they went in. I mean, there were a variety of approaches that were on the table. We spoke in previous editions of Left, Right, and Center about the expansive approach versus the narrow approach. The narrow approach ended up being the one that Pelosi pursued, probably for the better. But it just goes to show you that for different Democrats, there were probably different expectations of what could be accomplished. If it's to exact a political price, like Rich said, to damage Republicans in 2020, for instance, by widely depicting them as having been convicted of a certain kind of corruption, then, you know, I think that is a possible outcome. I don't think removal is especially likely. I don't know if Democrats really want to pursue that all the way to the end. I think that could be a very dangerous road.
Well, they want to. I mean, they'll vote for removal. Every Democrat, right? Except for maybe a Manchin or someone. But I would expect almost every Democrat to vote for removal, and then the over/under on the Republican votes probably about zero.
And, but would they vote for removal if they thought there was a chance that they would get a scatter of Republican votes that would actually put them over the top?
Would Democrats or would Republicans?
Would Democrats? I mean, is it a gesture? You know, that we all want him gone. This is something they've been saying since he was elected. Or do they really want to try to remove a sitting president for the first time in history?
I think they want to remove him. I think, you know, if 20 Republicans were going to vote to remove, I mean, what are you suggesting that if there were 20 Republican votes, then Democrats would get cold feet and say, actually, I don't want Mike Pence to be president? Why would they not want to remove him if removal was politically possible?
Well, Democrats keep saying, for instance, that they're afraid that Trump won't leave office if he loses fair and square in 2020. I mean, they've expressed all of these anxieties about the transition of power and whether it can be peaceful. And if they are really anxious about a sort of ordinary course transfer of power, then they should definitely be worried about the civil response to a removal via impeachment.
I think the best case Democrats have is impeachment is, they're not going to say this, but is an act of censure, you know, that will stand for all time. And Republicans did the same thing to Clinton, knowing he's probably very likely going to survive in the Senate. So they did it to our guy, we're going to do it to his, and this is a black mark. I think the downsides to that approach, one, is going to end in a Trump celebration. I mean, he's going to have a rally on the South Lawn of the White House after he's acquitted by the Senate. This is the biggest victory any president's ever had. There might be a military flyover, who knows what. And he might well get reelected. And what does that do to the impeachment power and to this act?
To Liz's theoretical concern, I think, you know, if people are worried that, you know, Trump's not going to leave office, they're worried about a situation where the Republican Party lines up behind him and defends him on whatever claim he's making. You know, maybe we have a very closely contested election and there's a state where people are fighting over who really won. And the institutional Republican Party agrees with him that, you know, that he won fair and square, even though he really lost. But in the theoretical circumstance where 20 Republicans have broken with him in the Senate to vote for his removal, he's lost key institutional support in the party. And so even if he tried to insist, you know, this impeachment was fake, I wasn't really removed, he would lack the institutional support he would needed to pull off a subversion of the rule of law. So I personally wouldn't worry too much about that. Jonathan?
I was going to say, we have to remember, I mean, put aside all the political calculus and machinations, that one of the arguments that the Democrats have made, particularly Speaker Pelosi, has made that I think is grounded in reality, and that is what this means about presidential power if Congress did not exercise its right to be a check and balance on the executive. If you just turn away because, oh, well, the Senate won't convict the president and thereby remove him in part two of the entire process, then we shouldn't do anything at all. And I think whether they win or lose in terms of removal of the president from office, I think is, to at least the leadership's mind, beside the point, because there's a larger issue at stake here. Is a president above the law? Can a president shoot someone on Fifth Avenue and get away with it. And in the circumstances that we find ourselves in now, had the Democrats not gone forward and pursued the impeachment inquiry, the answer to that question would have been yes.
So I think it also depends, though, how you define getting away with it. So a censure vote, you know, Kevin McCarthy's not going to support it. Most Republicans in the House aren't going to support it. But you'd get, I don't know, 10, 15 Republicans out of the House, and you'd get more than 50 votes for it in the Senate, depending on the wording and you know, who knows how the debate goes. But that would be a bipartisan measure to rebuke the president. It's just going all the way to impeaching and removing. That's the step too far, and you're not going to get any Republicans for it.
Actually, I have a question that follows from this that I want to get to, but I want to take a quick break first. I will be back with Rich Lowry of National Review, Elizabeth Brunig, and Jonathan Capehart of The Washington Post to talk more about impeachment, and then later we're going to talk about the Democratic presidential debate. You're listening to Left, Right, and Center.
You're hearing from our left, right, and center, and we want to hear from you, too. Tweet us at LRCKCRW and download the free KCRW app to listen to Left, Right, and Center on demand.
Back again with Left, Right, and Center. I'm Josh Barrow of New York Magazine. On the right is Rich Lowry, editor of National Review. On the left is Elizabeth Brunig, columnist at The Washington Post. And our special guest today is Jonathan Capehart, also a columnist at The Washington Post. So, Jonathan, you were saying before the break that impeachment is important as a statement from Congress that the president can't get away with it. And I guess my question is, get away with what? Because you've had a choice by Democrats. I mean, first, Nancy Pelosi and other Democrats in leadership were reluctant to impeach at all. Then we got the Ukraine scandal, and there was a shift in public opinion. There was a shift in opinion in the Democratic caucus, and they decided we're going to impeach over this. But they've taken what Liz referred to as a narrow approach. They picked a specific set of wrongdoings surrounding Ukraine, and they've been really wedded to a schedule. They want to get impeachment done by Christmas. And so as I've been watching testimony in the last couple of weeks, we've been learning more in the public testimony than I expected to. And we've also been seeing a lot of things that sort of indicate that there are documents and there are witnesses that we haven't seen or we haven't heard from that would have even more information, potentially explosive information. We haven't heard from Mick Mulvaney. We haven't heard from John Bolton. We haven't heard from Mike Pompeo. And so I guess my question is, if Democrats need to show that there's going to be accountability, is it proper for them to be moving so fast and deciding we're not going to go to court and try to compel testimony? If there's wrongdoing they haven't uncovered, shouldn't they be trying to uncover that before holding the impeachment vote?
I'm not going to argue that their political calculus in this regard might not be wrong. Once they do come up with articles of impeachment, it goes to the Judiciary Committee, and there could be opportunity then for more witnesses to become available, documents to be provided. But look, we're talking about an administration that is going to fight this tooth and nail, and has always used the courts. The president, when he was a private citizen, and even as president, has used the courts to deny and delay. And so if you are an institutional figure like Speaker Pelosi, and you know this about this person, that they're going to use the courts to slow things down, bring things to a halt, why... Knowing that, why would you wait? Why not keep going and push it over into the Senate where the whole new rules will apply and maybe new people and new testimony will come out? But as we've been talking about from the beginning of this conversation, and as Rich has said, and I think as Liz has said, there aren't the votes to remove the president at all. So right as we know right now. So I guess I'm arguing against myself here in that if you're Speaker Pelosi, why wouldn't you just speed up the calendar on this and get it moving?
I don't know. It's just she's saying she's prayerfully doing this, and this is the great, grave threat to our constitutional order, and you're not going to wait. You know, the courts would expedite this stuff 2 months. And it's clear why they're doing it, because they don't want to run into February 6th is the date they want this to be over with, because then you have the Iowa caucuses and you're really in re-election season. And so, yes, the White House is stonewalling and will make it hard to get these witnesses. I think there's at least a colorable claim of various forms of privileges or immunity, but we'd find out. But they're going to really leave an easy opening for Senate Republicans, who are going to quit anyway, Jonathan's right, but just say this is an incomplete case, and you it's incomplete because you're operating on a political timeline, and that would be completely true.
Liz, what do you say to that?
Yeah, I mean, you can say, well, we took a limited and narrow approach because it's what we had time for and because it was urgent and we didn't, you know, for whatever reason, want to expend a lot of extra time getting it established. And I think that, you know, who are you trying to satisfy with this story about why you expedited it? I really doubt it's going to be a point of a lot of contention.
Well, I mean, I think the other reason that one might proceed with an incomplete case, and this is, you know, maybe excessively an analogy to a criminal case, is that sometimes, you know, you have enough evidence to convict, and so you go ahead. There's more you could learn if you spent more time investigating, but there is enough. And so if you say, we know enough that the president did things that deserve removal from office, and that's why even though there would be more damaging information we would find, that's not why we're not going to spend another 2 months looking for information. I think that's plausible.
What's the big downside of 2 months, like, just on the merits?
Well, I mean, I'm not sure that the downside is huge. I mean, I think that, you know, it's fundamentally a political process, and to the extent that they think that interferes with other political prerogatives, I think that may be a good enough reason. Jonathan, you had something?
I was going to say on this notion of, you know, things being incomplete, it's incomplete because the president has blocked the Secretary of State, the acting chief of staff, the former energy secretary from testifying, from answering subpoenas, from appearing before Congress. So why would Democrats have to go to the courts to compel to see if a decision is made for them to testify? It's because the White House will not make these people available.
Yeah, so some of these, somewhere there is a core of executive privilege or immunity that does count as worth defending. I don't know where that line is. But if we can just circle back kind of the substance of what happened this week, Republicans have had to retreat, really, to the one thing we don't know. You know, with certainty, we can really intuit it, given the circumstantial evidence. But they retreated to the line, well, Gordon Sondland, you never heard him say, this is a quid pro quo, damn it. You know, and I want it right now, and that's why the defense money is being withheld. In fact, he formally denied that there's a quid pro quo. But to further establish it, you'd need to hear from these guys who are actually in the room all the time with Trump, like, you know, Mulvaney and Bolton and Pence and Pompeo, and we're not.
You know, Rich, something I'm wondering, though, is, you know, just because the impeachment inquiry officially ends doesn't mean we're not going to learn more information about this. Mm-hmm. In particular, part of the reason that this inquiry has been so productive is that there are a lot of people working in government who really do seem eager to tell people right. What happened. And so one thing I wonder about the politics of this is, you know, the president has been, you know, he really doesn't want any Republican defections. He's been making sure that he's trying to get as unanimous a Republican vote on his side as possible. That sort of means that to the extent this scandal continues to get worse between now and Election Day, Republicans, including in competitive districts, have been brought along to preemptively endorse whatever it is that we haven't learned yet about the president's mm-hmm. behavior. It feels like that's something that one should worry about, that there are other shoes that might drop. And because the inquiry is quick, it sort of in a way it could trap Republicans into standing with the president when, if it got a lot worse, maybe they would not have done so.
Just a sheer political matter, my guess, I could be wrong, is that this will feel so chewed over that 2 weeks after the trial ends, it'll feel pretty old and won't have much political valence, except for maybe in some of these swing House districts where you've had Democrats vote for the impeachment. Republicans will be pounding away on it. But, you know, it would be better for Republicans just admit it's clear what happened. There was a quid pro quo. The money was leveraged. The call wasn't perfect. And, you know, make the case about have the argument about the punishment. Instead, they've serially retreated from positions that were pretty clearly indefensible, if not from the start, after we had some more evidence.
There's another angle to the getting away with what question that also has to do with the scope of this inquiry. It's not just about how long you're going to wait. It's what are these articles of impeachment actually going to say? And Liz, I'm wondering what you think about a couple of things that Democrats have been talking about besides an allegation of bribery or extortion or however one might characterize the president's actions surrounding Ukraine and these investigations. One is that there's a question about whether the president should be impeached for lying to Robert Mueller. And that has to do with written answers that he gave that were contradicted actually by testimony in Roger Stone's recent criminal trial, where Rick Gates, who is the former deputy campaign manager to Donald Trump, said he heard President Trump taking a phone call from Roger Stone, where Roger Stone briefed him on upcoming WikiLeaks releases. The president had claimed in those written answers that he didn't receive any such briefings. And they're also talking about something to do with witness tampering, basically the president mean tweeting about Marie Yovanovitch in real time as she was testifying constituted obstruction of justice. And so given that, you know, there's a lot of wrongdoing to choose from here, even of things where the evidence is in, should Democrats be taking a broader approach in terms of what to impeach over?
Yeah, I actually supported the broader approach method going in. I think that the former case, you know, lying to Mueller is stronger than the witness tampering case. Of course, that's just one woman's opinion, and I'm not an attorney. So, I mean, I think that it's important for Democrats to select in terms of actually gathering up articles of impeachment, those things which are pretty much bulletproof and for which the evidence is very strong and the legal theory completely orthodox and solid. Otherwise, I think you risk kind of putting the credibility of the entire affair on the line by trying to advance a charge that is not necessarily so clear, or the theory is maybe a little bit more difficult to establish. I think that's the only thing that I would try to avoid in the process.
Jonathan, what do you think about that?
I have to agree with Liz. I mean, the whole reason why I think Speaker Pelosi jumped very relatively quickly on Ukraine, or to drive the impeachment inquiry because of the revelations about Ukraine, is because it was easy to understand. And by narrowing the focus and getting people having the committee focus in this way and not this broader approach, it focused the mind. It focused the attention of the American people. And as we've seen, as the hearings have gone on and as this impeachment inquiry has gone on, the support for taking action, for holding the president accountable, has gone up.
Well, it went up, but then it sort of stopped. And this is the thing that I wonder about the choice to move on a specified timeline. You had this sort of one-time move, apparently, when the Ukraine story broke. It really helped coalesce public opinion both in the electorate and then also in the Democratic caucus about whether the president should be impeached. But the polls have not materially moved in the last few weeks since we got that sort of one-step move. And I guess the question is, you know, would taking longer and gathering more information have a chance of really moving that? Because the way that this could end with removal would be if you had what happened with Richard Nixon, where his approval rating fell to 25%, and much of his Republican support had fallen away, and that changed incentives where a lot of Republican members in Congress broke with him. Now, I'm skeptical that a few more months of fact-finding would have any significant chance of resulting in that, but it seems to me that if the objective here was to move public opinion through the impeachment hearings, the hearings have failed. It was the initial news stories, and some of that had to do with machinations by these committees, but the presentation that Democrats have made, I don't think has been a success in terms of marshaling incremental public opinion in a way that matters.
I don't know about that, Josh. To say that it failed, Fiona Hill and David Holmes just completed testifying, mere hours ago. And so I think we're not really going to know the impact of these last 2 weeks for real until we get through Thanksgiving and, you know, poll out in the field to see where people are now that they have had a chance to not only digest turkey and stuffing and cranberry sauce, but also the deluge of information and news that broke continuously over a two-week period as patriot after patriot testified in these hearings about what was going on.
I mean, the hearings have been damaging to the administration and have been great for the Democrats. I agree with it. The question is whether they push the ball over the top for impeachment and removal. And I don't think they have. And I don't think on this universe of facts, it doesn't matter how long, how short, you're not getting there. I think the main jeopardy, and this is still open, you know, for another 2 months or something, is something else really big breaking that maybe Republicans would reach a breaking point. I have no idea what that would be. But I think you would need something different in addition to this. And again, the rush is political, and it's because Nancy Pelosi, in her heart of hearts, believes exactly the same thing I do, that it's ridiculous to impeach the president over this in any close proximity to the election. So she's trying to stay as far away from the election as possible.
No, I don't think Nancy Pelosi believes the same thing you do. I think Nancy Pelosi believes that they're not going to succeed in removing the president, and that as it gets closer to the election, that you start interfering with other political prerogatives of Democrats, whether that's about drawing attention to Democratic primary candidates, making sure that Democratic senators can actually be on the campaign trail, making their case as they run for president. Maybe it gets in the way of ratification of the USMCA trade deal, which some of her moderate members really want to get done so they can go back to their districts and say, look, I actually achieved something with the president. president even is going through this process. I don't think she has your substantive objection
so you think
to removal
like
of the president.
6 months out, she'd say, this is great politics, we're going to remove him?
I think
I mean, it's clearly part of, and I take all your point about those additional considerations, mm-hmm. but it's clearly part of the calculation, a major part of the calculation.
I think if Nancy Pelosi thought that dragging this process through April would mean that it would lead to the removal of Donald Trump, she would drag the process through April. I think she just doesn't see the upside. I don't know what this calendar is that you've come up with about dates on which you can and cannot remove the president. Certainly the Constitution doesn't set anything out about what's too close
right,
to an election to remove the president.
The strongest polling that Republicans have on this is just the question, should this be decided in an election or an impeachment process? And even polls that have shown a majority of people supporting impeachment removal, you put it that way, you know, it's high 50s. And I assume the closer you got to the election, the more people would feel that way, which is why, again, you can argue impeachment either way. Both sides do this. You can argue, oh, it's a legal process, so it's a political process. You know, it's a little of both. But clearly, it's a political consideration. The closer you get to the election, the harder the case is, not easier.
Liz?
I mean, I think ultimately my biggest concern about impeachment, and maybe I've become a little bit nervous just listening to other people on the left who are sort of anxious about the potential outcome of the process. But my biggest concern is that there will be something that comes along that's maybe a bit of a reach or that is difficult to establish in a way that allows the Trump administration to allege that Democrats are being nefarious or doing underhanded things or misrepresenting what he did. And I think that that's actually pretty avoidable at this point with the evidence that's in play. So I continue to hope that the short timeline prevents that kind of misstep.
Still with me are on the left, Liz Brunig of The Washington Post, on the right, Rich Lowry of National Review, and our special guest, Jonathan Capehart of The Washington Post. And now it's time for Tweets of the Week. Sometimes it only takes 140 characters or maybe 280 to distill the spirit of the week. Jonathan Capehart, what's your Tweet of the Week?
My tweet comes from Bakari Sellers, a former South Carolina state senator who is a supporter of Kamala Harris. He tweeted out, "Do y'all ever sit back and think about how much at Hillary Clinton was actually right about?" And Hillary Clinton retweeted him with the response, "Occasionally."
Rich Lowry, what tweet struck you?
My tweet is from my colleague Charlie Cook about a brewing controversy over the next Democratic debate, which Politico is participating in. And a Politico journalist named Tim Alberta used to work at National Review for about a year or so, and that is being used as a mark against him. And some Democrats are saying he shouldn't be a moderator, and Charlie tweets, and I wholly endorse this sentiment. Having worked with Tim Alberta, I'm irritated by the idea that he would be anything less than absolutely professional in any circumstance.
Liz Brunig, what's your tweet of the week?
Melissa Fabello, who lists herself as a PhD in her handle, tweeted, "P.S. Someone reached out and asked for an example of how you can respond to someone if you don't have the space to support them. I offered this template. Hey, I'm so glad you reached out. I'm actually at capacity or helping someone else who's in crisis or dealing with some personal stuff right now, and I don't think I can hold appropriate space for you. Could we connect at a later date and time instead, or do you have someone else you could reach out to? At this time of year, we're all blowing people off all the time, so I thought it was a great effort."
My tweet of the week is more of a toot of the week. Everyone was tweeting this clip from Congressman Eric Swalwell's appearance on MSNBC's Hardball.
"Taxpayer dollars to ask the Ukrainians to help them cheat an election. And the complaint that I've heard from..."
Various tweeters have been marshaling compelling evidence that Swalwell was not the farter, that he was framed. The fart actually came from MSNBC's Chris Matthews. But Hardball, for its part, says there was no fart at all, that you were hearing a mug scrape across a desk. Now that is gaslighting about gas. I've been talking with Liz Brunig and Jonathan Capehart of The Washington Post and Rich Lowry of National Review. We will be back to talk about the Democratic presidential primary debate. You're listening to Left, Right, and Center.
You're hearing civilized yet provocative opinions from all sides. Now we need to know what you think. Tweet us at LRCKCRW. Stream all episodes of Left, Right, and Center and our companion show, All the President's Lawyers, at kcrw.com/podcasts or from the KCRW app.
Back again with Left, Right, and Center. I'm your host, Josh Barrow. On the right is Rich Lowry, editor of National Review. On the left is Elizabeth Brunig, columnist at The Washington Post. And our special guest today is Jonathan Capehart, also a columnist at The Washington Post. The fifth Democratic presidential debate was held on Wednesday. For some reason, there were still 10 candidates on stage. It's my feeling that this was the least important debate so far. The candidates didn't get into it very much with each other. It was almost like a forum with a lot of people agreeing with each other, talking about why they're so great, rather than emphasizing any differences. Jonathan, I thought you had an interesting counterintuitive take on this. You were talking about this as sort of the re-rise of Kamala Harris. And I want you to make the case for that, because I think, you know, the polling has not been good for her. And there have been a lot of pre-mortems already getting written about what went wrong with her presidential campaign. What did you see that she did really well on Wednesday?
Okay, well, first, I have to disagree with you. I thought that of all the debates, this was the best debate. I think that they did get into it still over health care and Elizabeth Warren's plans to pay for this, that, and the other, and some discussion of tax policy. But I think for me, the debate was the third piece in two altogether of what I see as a reemergence of Kamala Harris. The first was when she gave her speech in Iowa at the Liberty and Justice Dinner in Des Moines, where from the moment she started speaking, I noticed a change in demeanor and a change in focus. And she gave the rationale in a 13-minute speech, gave the rationale for her candidacy with the tagline, "Justice is on the ballot," and then applying that to economic justice, healthcare justice, reproductive justice, economic justice. The second sign was the ad that dropped a few hours before the debate in Atlanta, where it was no nonsense, no cares given, going right at the president, where it opens by saying, look, you see this, and it's President Trump is in the frame, and then it dissolves to her and says, well, think about this. And she there makes the case for herself. And then the debate happens where gone is a lot of the laughter, gone was a lot of the caution. And as anyone who was riding high and down in the polls and coming into the stretch of when real people actually get to vote and not just, you know, talk to people doing polls, her back is up against the wall. And as I argue in the last sentence in my phrase, and maybe I'm hoping against hope that what we're seeing is a candidate who has been better than the campaign around her, deciding to run as if she has nothing to lose because she doesn't. And that's why I think Kamala Harris, of all the people on that stage, I would give the most improved star.
Liz, what do you make of that?
Yeah, I mean, I think that, you know, you can see reflected in the polling the fact that Harris has moved around. I think recently, the most recent polling I've seen suggests that she's actually traded third place or something like it for fourth with Buttigieg, who's on the rise. You know, the other places have switched around a bit between Biden, Warren, and Sanders. But ultimately, she hasn't sort of broken into a front runner place yet. I thought the entire debate was a little bit of a disappointment. I mean, it was pretty bloodless. It was kind of hard to watch. It seemed to drag on and on. Like you said, it's not really a debate. There are too many people for candidates to actually get a chance to actively go back and forth with each other at any length. So they just sort of end up answering questions. The moderation, of course, included our very own Ashley Parker from The Washington Post. She did a great job. But I thought a lot of Rachel Maddow's questions were just kind of weird, took up a lot of time without really getting to know any of the candidates' positions better. I think we've had better debates.
Rich, what were your takeaways?
I thought it was a very dull kind of status quo debate. I've been paying a lot of attention to Pete Buttigieg lately. I think he I've been focused on how articulate he is and in what way. And this debate sort of brought home to me. At times I thought he speaks as well as Obama, but I think he really speaks as well as Romney, which is a different thing. Mitt Romney, every single debate he was ever in, gave perfect answers to everything, spoken, just clear, organized, flawless paragraphs. But you could almost see the text being downloaded in his head. And it's sort of the same thing Mayor Pete in this debate. That's not quite a fair characterization. You had an exchange with Tulsi Gabbard where he improvised and I think won this exchange over foreign policy and meeting with leaders of rogue states. But even this, just loading down text in your head, is a major skill that most politicians don't have. But he lacks kind of the music that Barack Obama had in his oratory. But he's, you know, this depends a lot whether you're looking at the national polls or the early, at least the first two early state polls. Buttigieg now has a clear lead in Iowa. Still early. I think, you know, there could be surprises there. But is a truly formidable candidate. I thought Biden had an okay debate. You know, there's always going to be gaffes. But generally, he was crisper than before and has been more resilient than the conventional wisdom, including me at times, has given credit for, at least in the national polling and in South Carolina. And then I think someone who really got off the hook was Elizabeth Warren, who's basically totally flip-flopped, more or less, on Medicare for All, where she now says she's going to pass it in the third year of her administration, a prospective administration, when every incumbent president loses Congress or has some major drubbing in Congress. So the idea that then at that moment you're going to turn around and pass the most sweepingly ambitious healthcare law in all of American history is completely ridiculous and is a sign that she wants to wiggle her way out of this thing.
I should note, as I have previously, my husband is a Democratic fundraising operative. The Buttigieg for President campaign is one of his clients. Jonathan, I want to ask you about one of the more spirited exchanges of the debate, or series of exchanges, which had to do with black support in this election and who can earn the trust of black voters, who can mobilize them and treat them as the key part of the Democratic Party coalition that they are. And I thought it was sort of odd how much of that exchange was carried between Kamala Harris and Pete Buttigieg when overwhelmingly the candidate who's doing best with black voters is Joe Biden. I mean, it's unfortunately kind of difficult to find national polls that have a large enough African-American sample for a good crosstab. But South Carolina, certainly the polls have large enough. The most recent Quinnipiac poll in South Carolina had among black voters Biden 44, Sanders 10, Warren 8, Harris 6, Booker 2, and Buttigieg 0. And so it's sort of strange to me that you have these candidates, you know, arguing over who has the best, you know, the best relationship to the black community, the best ability to appeal to the black community, when it's clear that, like, on that metric, the obvious leader is Joe Biden.
Right. Well, we have to keep something in mind. Mayor Pete is the candidate on the rise. And the big knock against him is, great, you're on the rise, but what about South Carolina? And South Carolina is extremely important, one, for the reasons that you state, but also keep this number in mind, 62%. 62% of the Democratic electorate in South Carolina is African American. And so while Mayor Pete is ahead in Iowa, surging in New Hampshire, if he can't win South Carolina, then that does not bode well for him getting the nomination. The reason why Vice President Biden is riding high in the national polls and riding high in South Carolina is because of that African-American support. And I think what particularly Senators Harris and Booker are hoping is that if Vice President Biden does indeed falter before South Carolina, that African-American voters will turn to them as the alternative to him. Vice President Biden is the person who they have, African-American voters have known him for decades. He was vice president to President Obama, who is still extremely popular among African-American voters. And so that's why I think that conversation was happening between Mayor Pete, who's on the rise, and Senator Harris, who took a knock at him over some issues with some campaign literature, but also as an African-American candidate in the race who is not garnering the support that people thinks that she should garner for being African-American.
Here's why that would be such a remarkable bank shot, though. And I was struck by the statistic that first of all, you need 15% in a given contest in order to get delegates out of the contest. People talk about this as a proportional race, but it's not totally proportional. If you come out with 8% of the vote, you get nothing. And in the modern nominating history in the Democratic Party, there has never been one of these contests where you had four candidates come out of the contest with at least 15% of the vote. That even when it's fragmented, it's not so fragmented that you get four above the 15 threshold. The polling is suggesting that that's a plausible outcome in Iowa. You have polls that have all four of Buttigieg, Biden, Warren and Sanders at or above 15%, and with a substantial number of undecideds out there, they could all go higher. They could all cross that threshold. The scenario that Jonathan is describing is one where then you come out of Iowa, and then the nominee ends up being someone who is not among those four, that you have those four candidates, all of whom are white, who end up breaking that threshold. But Biden is weakened, or maybe Biden doesn't make the threshold. Maybe it's the other three white candidates who get over the threshold. And then you have Kamala Harris or conceivably Cory Booker, who have not shown traction in Iowa and New Hampshire, then are able to come in South Carolina and win the nomination. I mean, I would say stranger things have happened, but I actually don't think stranger things have happened than that in the Democratic nominating process. It would posit a much more open field than we've seen ever before.
Well, I would say in answer to that, Josh, that African-American voters, I agree with you. We could see this stranger thing happen because African-American voters are energized. Black women in particular are super energized because of what they have seen the power of their vote do since the special election in Alabama, since the election of the governor in Virginia, since the 2018 midterm elections, and a whole lot of other elections that I can't think of off the top of my head. And so if we do have a situation where Mayor Pete, Senator Warren, and Senator Harris come out of Iowa and Biden is nowhere to be found, and then you go to New Hampshire where Sanders and Warren and Deval Patrick are on the ballot, and they are, you know, they have home field advantage because they're from states close to New Hampshire, then South Carolina, and I could see black voters saying, hold up, wait a minute, we have not had our say yet, and we're going to have it. And also, let's remember, South Carolina is not the only ball game when it comes to African-American voters. 3 days later will come Super Tuesday, where more black voters will have a chance in the South to go to the polls and make their selections known, their voting preferences known. So, I long-winded way of saying, Josh, I agree with you. Stranger things have happened, and this strange thing could possibly happen.
Liz, one interesting implication of that, and I think it's matched by the polls that we've seen over the last month, at least if you look at the tracker from The Economist, Warren sort of came close to where she was going to meet or overtake Biden in the national polls. Her position has receded a little bit. Bernie Sanders has been flat around 15, though, with a lot of variation upward or downward in national polls. And the candidate who's picked up a little bit as Warren has dropped off some is Pete Buttigieg, who is, you know, still in high single digits nationally, even as he's doing better in Iowa and New Hampshire. So that's a little bit of a swing away from the more progressive candidates toward the more moderate candidates. And I'm wondering what you make of that, because I mean, people talk about Joe Biden as the candidate whose coalition looks most like the Democratic Party as a whole, and that's true. But as I highlighted in that South Carolina poll, the candidates who are second and third with black voters are Elizabeth Warren and Bernie Sanders. So it feels like they've almost been left a little bit out of the conversation in terms of who could build a diverse coalition. They have shown at least a pulse with black voters, and conceivably they could be the ones who swoop in and build a majority coalition.
Yeah, I mean, I think that's very likely, and I think it makes a lot of sense. I mean, both Warren and Sanders work from a kind of left populist rhetoric, which makes perfect sense for building a multiracial coalition and building, especially a working class coalition, the kind of blue wall type politics that Hillary Clinton counted on but then ultimately couldn't pull off, I think come very naturally to Sanders and Warren. So I actually am pretty sanguine about their chances of managing to represent the Democratic Party as a whole. On the other hand, as it was pointed out, you know, the last time Sanders ran, there are reasons that certain voters, black voters in particular, are nervous about a very, very progressive candidate. There is concern about how they would fare in the general. The stakes are pretty high this time because we know what a Trump presidency actually looks like. So that's how I account for the bumps up and down for these progressive candidates. Is they're very appealing. Their politics are very appealing. But primary voters do get nervous about whether or not they're going to be able to hang in there in the general. And I think that accounts for a lot of the sway.
We've reached that time once again for our famed Left, Right, and Center rants featuring pet peeves from across the political spectrum. Rich Lowry, it's your soapbox.
We've heard a lot of worry lately about the undermining of our institutions. And one way to do that is to posit dastardly conspiracies that changed election results. This is exactly what National Democrats are doing in the case of Stacey Abrams, the Georgia Democrat who lost by a narrow but clear majority in a fair, high turnout gubernatorial election. Democrats should just accept the election result and stop deceiving themselves and others about what happened.
Liz Brunig, what's your rant?
Everybody's concerned about climate change on the left, and for good reason. Climate change is a serious problem and one that we failed to take adequate action against. But a lot of people are now writing about or thinking about or considering or contemplating undergoing certain surgical procedures. In an essay this week, a man talked about getting a vasectomy in order to prevent himself from having children, and that's his contribution to fighting climate change. And I don't think you need to take that kind of measure. Remember, there are technological solutions to climate change. There's a great possibility of political action against climate change. Don't be a climate change pessimist. We can still get this.
Jonathan Capehart, what's on your mind?
Well, Josh, I was going to mourn over the death of the Republican Party as I was taught to see it after two terms of Reagan, a term of H.W., and two terms of W. But instead, I'm going light, and I'm going to rant about men's pants. men's pants, thankfully, now fit. They're form-fitting. It's great. But men, please, for the love of God, stop jamming your pockets with everything that you own. Your wallet, your big phone, whatever else is in there. You're ruining the line. There are people in fashion who spent hours, if not years, designing the perfect look, and you're ruining the line by jamming your pockets with all of your worldly possessions.
For my rant, President Trump gave a very strange interview on Fox and Friends this Friday. He continued to push this conspiracy theory that the DNC server is in Ukraine and he wants to get it out so we can see it. This theory is wrong for a number of reasons, including that there is no physical DNC server and never was. It is a cloud server. It was not anywhere. But that's not the key point. He also talked about China and said he stands with Hong Kong, but he also stands with President Xi. And obviously, it doesn't really work like that. Congress has passed legislation by overwhelming majorities standing up for political rights in Hong Kong and authorizing sanctions against the Chinese officials who violate them. This is heading to the president's desk, and if it vetoes it, there's plenty of support in Congress to override him. Trump should sign the legislation. He should stop telling anyone who will listen that he doesn't care about human rights so long as we can sell soybeans to China. That's all we have time for today. I want to thank Rich Lowry, Liz Brunig, and Jonathan Capehart. Left, Right, and Center is produced by Sarah Fay. Our technical director is JC Swadek. Colin Cab Washington and PJ Shahamat are our production assistants. Tadim Simon composed our theme music. I'm Josh Barrow. Thanks for joining us, and tune in next week for more Left, Right, and Center.
Download and subscribe at kcrw.com/LRC, the KCRW app, or wherever you find podcasts. Left, Right, and Center is produced and distributed by KCRW.